minute.
This week on the House of Static, part one of our conversation about music, philosophy, and living with cancer, with Las Vegas singer, songwriter, composer, producer, and educator, Noah Avery.
Wait, we should introduce ourselves and then we can talk like this normally, and that'll be a great episode. This
cool.
Oh, that's a good point. I should
this
probably
is the House of Static. Sorry. I'm and Bob Smith, and that's Kilo House. So now that we've got that out of the way.
Wait, stop, reverse that.
Wait, yeah. No, the other way around.
There you go.
He's the static part because he's the static dive
right
on Kilo House on the house part. Now we got it right.
Okay, there you go, now
back to the normal people conversation. I love it.
Well, since we're starting now, right? So we'll do an actual introduction of Noah as well. So Noah Avery is our guest today. There you go, Noah. How's it going? Noah's a musician, obviously, as we all are here. If you're watching this, you might know that I have a blog, a music blog, and I write about musicians on it. That's the kind of nature of the beast. And Noah is one of those, actually, Kilo is one of those musicians as well. It's how I know everybody. So, yeah, right. So Noah, we'll get deep into the details of all the of everything he's done, but basically since 2018, 2019, Noah's released an album every year, basically about four albums. And each time he's been kind enough to send them to me so I could, write about them on the blog. So, the fun thing about this podcast so far, this YouTube show podcast, Noah, is that we've done this a number of times where I'm getting to meet people that I've been talking to for two or three years. And now I can actually put a face and a voice to it's really cool.
Right on.
Noah and I have had a pretty, pretty long friendship here where we've never actually spoken to one another. So it's
and
nice.
He makes amazing music.
Yes,
I get to check out our artists, and I've loved every artist we've had on here. Probably we won't air the episodes that we don't actually like the music.
Right.
I was gonna say, like, I'm surprised I like all the artists, but I'm like, well, I probably wouldn't put it on my own show if I don't like the artists. That
there
would be
go.
Kind right of on. A bad idea. So, but I want to hear what you were gonna say to Noah, Bob, as a normal conversation thing.
What was I gonna say?
Start the show.
I was going to ask Noah. I did ask you, Noah, if you had watched any of the episodes so far. And you said,
I did.
Right. So, in order to kind of give you a background of who you know who I am, and I believe you must know who Kilo is now as well, since you've been watching the show. So, we can skip that, I guess. But anyway,
if they've made it this far into the season, they probably know who we are by now.
That's a good point.
At the beginning, we introduce ourselves and tell people who we are and what we did.
Right.
Now we don't have to do that as much, hopefully.
There you go. So
I'm going to have to remember what I've done, and I don't want to do that right now.
So how about Noah? Noah, why don't you tell us who you are and what you're, and then we'll go from there. How about that?
Yeah. All right. First, thanks for having me, guys. It's awesome to chat music. Right. I don't necessarily get to chat music with a lot of people day to day.
We hear that often, actually.
Yeah.
We hear that from a lot of people.
Yeah, and when I do, it certainly... a lot of times it's about other types of music or different things that I get involved in.
Right.
But I am Noah Avery. I write, arrange, compose, perform different things. And I've, like Bob said, I've put out four albums here since 2018. I'd love to be able to keep the average up one a year, but I don't know if that's going to happen. I've got a lot of backstory, but I'm sure we'll cover some of that throughout all of this.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Why don't we start with where you're from? Because our audience might not know.
Yeah, I'm out in Vegas. So I moved to Vegas maybe 18 years ago.
And, where'd you move from?
I was living up in Chicago at the time. I went to school up there, so I came to Vegas to kind of start working and teaching and getting my feet wet, and ended up staying. And now once you have roots somewhere, it's kind of home. So
I completely agree.
And I absolutely love the West Coast.
You're a music teacher out there, right?
Yeah, I was. I no longer teach, but I taught for 15 years out here. Mm-hmm. And waved my arms and did the whole nine yards.
Nice.
Taught in a variety of different settings and everything from different ensembles and conducting, you know, symphony and working with big bands to teaching songwriting and theory and different things. So
very cool.
Right on.
Yeah, that's kind of the 15 year part of being in Vegas. And then here the last stretch of years has been different, but yeah, in such a wonderful way.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah.
So why don't we start with like more of the earlier years though? Like what got you interested in music? Like what was some of the first music you listened to? What made you start making music? What was the first instrument you played? Just a little bit of a backstory in that area.
Oh yeah. I started actually on sax, and I knew that I was going to play saxophone from like an insanely early age. You know, you feel kind of inclined to one thing. And so
right.
I knew that was the direction I was going to go. So I started playing sax at a very young age. And then I was, I would say, compelled into making music my life by other great musicians, you know, seeing
right.
People do it well and kind of master the art. And then, of course, right. It speaks to me like right. A lot of other things can't. So I poured all my eggs in that basket from a very young age. And started on sax and then eventually started to pick up other instruments, you know, I would imagine we all have similar stories with that. Sure. Whether or not you know how to play it, you put it in your hands and start to, bang and pluck and see what happens. So I'd say probably the first giant true influence in this kind of genre is Pink Floyd. That was definitely a beginning point, you know, with these long sort of stretched out compositions and trying to blend some psychedelic ideas into the music. And then the idea of, you know, combining music with visual things, which unfortunately you can't exactly get from an album that you're listening to through headphones, but
synesthesia. Oh, whoa, I'm echoing really bad. Does anybody else hear that? I think I'm loud on someone's computer. Okay, it's better now, whatever. Anyways, okay. Can you hear me, guys? Yeah?
I hear you fine.
Yep.
Okay, then maybe I'm crazy. Unless you have synesthesia like I do, where music turns into colors and images in the brain, then you literally get a visual whole thing out there, but I know what you're saying for sure.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think that also carries away because, you know, a lot of my training was in art music and jazz and those mediums. And so a lot of times that's what history has done. They've gone from music that exists just absolute on its own to then marrying together some different art forms to get really a multi-sensory experience.
Right. I was just gonna say my glasses are being weird.
We're having a hard time already.
What the hell's
don't
going on?
Worry
anyway. What was I gonna ask? Oh yeah, well, one of the things when Kilo and I, you know, we were talking earlier about what we were going to talk about today, talk about you and talk about, we were listening to your album together and, you know, and that kind of thing, the most recent Roundwood, which, by the way, anyone watching will go into the details of each one later, but Noah's most recent album is called Roundwood. It's freaking brilliant and it's beautiful and you should listen to it. It really is. But anyway, what I was going to ask though is that, you know, you've kind of launched this project of these four solo albums about 3 or 4 years ago. But what you do, I know what you did before that. You know, you were a teacher and you went to music school and you learned all these things. But did you produce music before that? Were you in a band? Did you have other solo stuff that you didn't release? Like where, cause you started like fully.
Yeah, how
formed.
Did you fucking come out of nowhere? And yeah. Like, bam.
Exactly. Your first album sounds like Pink Floyd's 10th album. You know what I mean? Like, it's funny, it came perfectly formed already. So, yeah.
I want to point out that you said Pink Floyd, and he actually, Bob had told me your music sounded like Pink Floyd before I had actually heard it. He was like, it's like Pink Floyd-ish. And I was like, cool, man. So you kind of emulated the vibe.
Yeah.
So.
Technically, I would say it was more Roger Waters than Pink Floyd, right? So Pink Floyd, for those who are not music nerds, like the three of us, Pink Floyd was four guys. Then Syd Barrett went insane. So they got a different fourth guy, which is David Gilmour. And they did a thing for, you know, a few years. Then around 1984, the smart guy in the band, Roger Waters, who wrote all the music, said, I'm all done doing this now. I'm going to make solo albums. So
yeah, I'm done doing it with you. That's
exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so the question is, did you do that to somebody else?
Yeah, you go, there you
I'm
go.
Done doing this with you. Now I'm going to be Noah by myself.
Right. Now I started out and played in bands coming up through college. Most of those gigs were actually playing sax and, you know, woodwinds. So a lot of the bar gigs, so to speak, were spent blowing and playing.
Right.
I did eventually sort of morph over into writing and wanting to write my own stuff. And I don't know exactly what to call it. I know that we'll cover it, but pop music is all I can say, something down that line. But I've been writing, you know, for ages and recording and kind of hiding away in a bedroom and doing it.
Yeah.
And then in my other life, you know, when I changed hats, I was composing and writing things that were recorded and published in different places. Mm-hmm. So the journey is strange because I've always been connected to pop music, but then a large chunk of my life, you know, was spent doing legit music and writing and composing that way. So I do have, you know, and again, I would imagine it's true for most of us. I do have songs tucked away that no one will ever hear and probably should never hear.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then sometimes, you know, you want to dust one off and then you have to try to get ears on it to go, okay, is this sentimental to me? Yeah. Or is it actually good? Is it something that I can still kind of stand behind?
Right.
But no, most of the stuff on the albums, almost all the stuff on the albums is not older things. It's just stuff that was written currently.
Right.
As far as a fully formed sound, though, it's funny to think that way because I think every time I set out to start writing for an album, I have no clue what my sound will be.
Right.
You know, I have some guideposts of things I want to try and do, but the way it comes out happens so organically in the way that it ends up. No matter how much I try, I can't get myself out of the sound, whether it's electronic or, you know, acoustic guitar. It seems to always come through that way. Yeah.
Well, you know, so, and that's, you know, that's what kind of leads into some of the details of the albums themselves, right? So, as far as stylistically, you mentioned, you know, whether you're electric or acoustic, and the albums actually progress, you know, from one to the next in it. Like, you've got an album called The Digital Life, which is much more digital music compared to, although it's, none of your music is strictly analog or digital. It is a very much an, you know, but anyway, but what I was getting at though, is that as far as the four albums go, and I don't know how deeply you would like to get into this, but you know, there's a theme to them. There's a, you know, you had some health issues over the last few years, and that I believe was what spawned the whole project, and definitely informs much of your music, right? So,
yeah.
So tell, if you'd like to, you want to tell it, do you want to talk about that?
Absolutely. There's no secrets here.
Right. On.
Yeah. There is a, sometimes a ticking clock that can chase you from behind. And so I think a lot of the albums that have come out have been that, this pushing sense of urgency. Oh, hey, Kat. I was 35 and waving my arms and conducting. And went down in front of a group of musicians and woke up in a hospital. Ooh. And yeah, the next morning is when they said I had cancer. So, yeah.
You were like working, you were conducting and collapsed. Wow.
Oh, yeah.
That's crazy.
Traumatized people, I'm sure. I think it was far worse for them at the moment. I don't remember any of it. But yeah, I was in the process of working and fixing and trying to do things. And then everything went left. I mean, like that.
Right.
And so I woke up the next day and they told me I had cancer. And then started the process of navigating things that I had no clue about, you know, mm-hmm. aside from a cursory level of maybe a family member that's gone through a cancer, but no, you know, no nuts and bolts of it. So after that happened, that was right at the very beginning of 2016. I went through all the process of trying to get it out of me, radiate it out, and chemo, and cut it out, whatever they could do to get it out. And we thought we had it. And so I kept working and teaching and sort of, it's funny, I'd go down like on a lunch break and do my radiation and then come back and get in front of the group. But in 2018, it came back. And that's around, I think, the time of the lone image.
Yeah.
Because my life by necessity started to sort of shift. And I couldn't be making music here, but I couldn't not be making music.
Right.
So it just sort of pulled one direction, a great direction. So kind of facing that has changed everything. Not only has it changed me, but it's changed my music. It's changed what's important musically and not musically in the world. And perspective can do a great deal to take the weights off, the self-imposed weights that artists sometimes put on themselves.
Absolutely.
You have to get the next thing out, or the next thing has to be better than the last thing. It's got to be perfect. It's got to be great. And you want all those things. But when you're not sure that you can get to the time to release it, then that urgency takes precedence over some of these other maybe self-conscious thoughts and ideas we have.
Right.
So in 2018, it came back and had metastasized in such a way that it couldn't be cured or fixed. So it is the proverbial death sentence, although I'm still alive.
Right.
So I'm not sure how that works. the albums come from that place, and you very elegantly, you know, write about it in your own. And we've never gone super deep into it, you and I. And then you kind of pull from that meanings that connect directly with me, which is kind of amazing. But then other side meanings and things that you pull from it, which I really enjoy hearing about. But the music kind of goes with that. The digital life is like in the heat of deep, deep, horrible chemo. And the Unnamed Road was also in that spot.
Well, one thing I would say about that is that one thing that strikes me listening to, as you point out, I have listened to all four pretty thoroughly, you know. And one thing that strikes me is that they get more positive as you go on.
Yeah.
Like the most recent album is it's your most like zen sort of settled kind of cool play. You're in a better place in your last album than in when you first, the first one is very much, you can feel the, you know, that you were recently diagnosed, and you can feel the fear and the anxiety and the, you know, the worry for your family and everything. And that's all still there all the way through all four albums, but it's a healthier, more mature perspective on it by the time you're at the last album, the fourth album, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's remarkable. And I don't know if that's a testament to you as a human being and your resilience, and it is, but it's also maybe a testament to the music itself, like the healing power of that music. Cause I've always thought because all my friends are musicians, and you guys are probably the same way. Everybody I know is, I mean, they're either some sort of weird artist or a musician, right? And we have we have our art as our, as the chronicle of our lives, right? I don't have photo albums, you know, I have 500 songs that I've written since I was 18 years old, right? Or 16 years old. And I can listen, if I want to remember, what was it like in Florida when I was 21 years old and living in Florida? I got 100 songs from when I lived in Florida I could listen to, you know? And I guess that's, you know, that's that kind of power of music to encapsulate a moment, you know, and a feeling and who you are at that time. And that's what I get from your albums.
Even for people, though, that don't make music that are watching this, they would probably agree that listening to certain songs, for me, listening to certain songs reminds me of a time I lived in Oklahoma or when I lived in Colorado Springs or stuff like that. So music just in general reminds us of, like, it's a very nostalgic thing. You hear a song and it reminds you of a wedding you went to or whatever. But I think what Bob is saying, as an artist, we feel a deeper feeling with that. We have that visceral emotion that we were going. That's why when I got out of the hospital, when I almost died, I chose not to write music for the time of getting off of the pain medicine and all the stuff I had to do to recover, because I did not want those emotions latched onto my art. You know, so that's something I was wanting to talk to you about. Do you feel like you use your music as like a coping mechanism or a healing thing? Or are you doing it purposefully for a purpose and you're like, you know, grinding your teeth and just getting through it for others?
Oh, God, no. In my brain, there are no others, you know.
Right. No, we agree with you. Don't worry.
Yeah.
But that's
we're all myopic musicians here. Yeah.
Yeah, I am the only one. But no, I think that's part of the freedom of it is when you realize that all the glory you sought, even if you get it, is not the glory you thought that you would get. Right. Because without that, like Kilo, you were just saying, without that satisfaction of knowing that what you've done is what you intended to do, that you didn't let either the need to produce for someone interfere with it, or that you weren't true to yourself because of the place you were in. I think that's incredibly important. And nostalgia is the exact word. I mean, it's because it's not just cerebral. It's not just memory.
Right.
You put on a song and go, oh, yeah, I remember writing that when I was 19.
Right.
You feel something that gets you back to 19 for a moment. You go back into that strange and sometimes wonderful headspace, you know, and I think that is the power of music. It's not that we can necessarily, because I've heard it said about, you know, composers, is that they can transfer you into their mind, their state of mind. And I used to think that, but then I think it started to evolve in, no, I can give them like a colored glass that they can look through to see the world. And then their mind is still running. So I can put something out in the space with art. And then the actual, what it means is out of my hands at that point.
Right.
Because we're all so different. You know, someone may want to skip right to a track that just kind of bumps along and has a nice ambient section where nothing's changing. And that's what they want. It means something different. And I think that's a critical part of art, and the reason I'm so productive lately is that I realize that what I'm doing is, first of all, for no one, because, you know, I'd like to say there's thousands of people stopping by every day to wish me well and tell me their thoughts on music, but it's not that it is something very personal that I do for myself.
Yeah, you know, a lot of what you said a lot there, and you kind of triggered some thoughts in my head when you were saying it. And one thing, it reminded me when you were talking about the stained glass, like a filter that you're providing to the world, to listeners. Like, you can look at the world through this filter if you like, and interpret it as you see fit. Right. It's very similar to the episode that aired last week, Lisa Leland, an artist in France.
She was in France.
Yeah,
is that right?
Yeah. She's fantastic. She's very cool. And And one of the things she said was, because I was talking to her about her lyric writing, and this is good, comes back to you in very much the same way, because I had said how, you know, she writes very poetic lyrics and non-specific. You get the vibe of what she's saying, but right. She doesn't say, I was walking down the street and then I saw a cat and then I went right. to the store. You know what I mean? It's not literal right. like that. It's not linear.
Help. I'm dying of cancer. Help.
Right. Exactly. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So when I was talking to Kilo earlier today, I was about your music and I was relaying. So you know, Kilo's had his own medical issues over the years, and he's
all of the issues.
So, but we were, and we talk about that, right? So Kilo was telling me a story a couple weeks ago, when he was just, I won't give the details, but he was laying in a hospital bed and he could hear doctors talking out in the other room. And
details are good. You can cut them out later.
Right.
You can go into the, do you want me to tell the story, Bob?
Well, maybe one second. Cause what I want to say why sure. I'm bringing it up, because when I'm bringing it up, is, right. The reason I'm bringing it up is that I was telling Kilo how you're telling similar stories in your music. Right. And Kilo's like, hey, you know, which song does he say that where he's laying? And I'm like, it's not how Noah writes. You know, there isn't a song where I can go, that's the one where he's talking about, you know, being depressed in the hospital. But he is, at least that's what I heard. And it doesn't matter what song it's in. You know what I mean? Right. It's right. there. It's there. And I felt it. And that's what I was getting at. So anyway, sorry, Kilo. Yeah. Please tell your story.
No, I don't need to share my story. This is not
I want to hear the story. All right. I'm the odd man out.
I feel your pain of like passing out and waking up somewhere because, in I think it's 2018, I woke up in a hospital bed. In like, obviously I was awake supposedly some of the time, but like 10 days after going to the hospital with necrotizing pneumonia in my right lung. And so basically like I had to have surgeries and have things taken out of my lungs. And the part that Bob is telling is when they took my parents out into the hall and they were like, we don't know if he's going to survive this. He's probably, and I'm like, you're right the fuck there. You didn't close the door.
You're trying
to pretend that you're trying, but like that's what Bob was talking about with that story. I don't think I've told it on the program, but I mean, and it's funny. I wanted to say, I know your pain, but I don't know your pain. No one knows anyone else's pain, right? Right. And mine True. Is something that is fixable or was fixed. They had to take 1/3 of my lung out, but it was fixable eventually. It took years to get kind of better. I'm still on that swing getting better. But I do think those moments where you have to face reality and go, life is fucked. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to be dark. It's the moments where good artists come out. I don't even know why I just brought that up. No, but it's like something that I think you probably can identify with, where it's like,
oh God, yeah.
You give up on giving a shit. And you're like, well, life is just a fucking shit show. Welcome to the shit show. Like, then you can start really writing the music you want. Because right. before I went to the hospital, like I wrote some good songs and stuff. But once I started writing again after I detoxed off of the methadone that I had to be on, I started writing the genre I write now, which is terror trap, which is horror-based EDM trap music. But sure. It's like, it's funny that you say that put the glass up vibe type of thing, because my music actually comes from a happy place, yet it sounds very dark. So it's like
that happens.
I know, right? It's like yeah. It's like in my mind, it's a pretty picture. To most people's minds, it's a horror show.
Right, you know, like, right.
It's like what the fuck are you doing? But anyways, yeah, I've babbled about myself enough. So
I think you got it, man. That, yeah. I think that's it.
Right. It's funny because I've a band I really like is Fish. Uh-huh. And so the live experience, if you listen to their music on my album, so much of it is light and happy and fluffy and then without a doubt, then they jump into a jam or start to improvise together. Mm-hmm. It just can get so wicked.
Oh, yeah.
It's so overpoweringly dark. And you're going, wait, why aren't we just thinking about rainbows over here? And it's perfect because you don't know you're getting there, but you get there with them. And that's quite a journey to take.
Right. And I think that shows where the human really is. Because I think I said in one of our earlier episodes, like, my music shows me where I'm at in my mental space. When I write it, I realize where I'm at. Right.
Right.
Yeah. So it's like a reflection back at you. And so it's like, yeah, sometimes our brains just suddenly go into dark places that we, like having ADHD people, like you'll go suddenly be in a dark thought and you're like, where the fuck did you come from? You know, type of thing. But I think music is a great way to kind of do a spot check of like, mental health check. How are you doing today? Oh, cool. You just wrote that. You need to go, you know, chill out for a minute, bro, type of thing.
Oh, but yeah.
It's so healing, you know, as well.
Absolutely.
See, I never know what my music means until like 6 months later. Really? Seriously, because I write like everything I write is just so everything is improv. Everything is off the top of my head. And then I refine it later. You know what I mean? I kind of jam with myself, whether it's keyboards or guitar or whatever. And then I rewrite. I've talked about that before. But the point is that I don't know what any of it means until somebody tells me later on. Which is funny because, I mean, I spend my day telling other people what music means. You know what I mean? Like, hey, right, this is what this song, you know, this is what I do. My own music, I have no idea what I'm talking about.
Well,
sometimes that's a good thing, you know, to not explicitly know what it's about, because that can forever change.
Right, exactly.
You know, the way you hear a song.
Good point. Good point.
I think probably when you wrote Zen Seeds, though, you kind of knew what you were writing about, considering, like, no, okay,
not really. I really.
Anyone who can't see the program, he just nodded his head with a like. No.
I mean, like, I really just—it's very visceral. My whole process.
I actually literally just listened to Zinzi before we came on, because I was trying to make things look presentable, you know.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I was listening to it. So when you write, it comes from a kind of a non-analytical emotional space. You just write.
Yeah, which is funny because I'm actually a pretty, I mean, for 25 years, I was an IT guy. I'm actually a pretty, you know, analytical guy. I mean, most people would laugh at that because I'm insane. But when I'm working on something, I'm very logical. You know what I mean? I'm very technical and logical. Everything else, I'm a complete lunatic, but I'm very logical with that. But anyway, I'm not logical with my music. I'm a lunatic. There you go. And Zen Seeds,
one of my best friends and fellow musician around here actually went to school to be an engineer. And he's exactly that type of brain where he's got calendars just stored in there,
right,
you know, in days of the week. And then once he was at school is when he changed over to music, and he has the same vibe because he's brilliant as a musician, very good, but he is a super nerd. I mean, things go in boxes and they all have a place that they fit, you know, and so it's quite the marriage.
Yeah.
We pulled it off. So
crazy, crazy stuff.
Bravo.
That's very cool. So we mentioned that you have four albums that you've recently released. What would you say your favorite, if you can pick one favorite child, what would your favorite of the four albums be and why? What does it mean to you?
Oh, man. That's obviously always a tricky thing, isn't it?
Right.
I would probably go to the Unnamed Road as being, for me, my favorite. Just simply because, as Bob kind of said with the Lone Image, there's some angst. And there's a lot of uncertainty. And then there's also this idea of, I'm going to finally just put these things out to the world. And that can be a little nerve-wracking. And so that first album was its own experience of making it. But with the Unnamed Road, after the diagnosis came back and I got in there working and I was, you know, doing my thing medically, it gave me all this time because I couldn't be conducting and doing that anymore. So I had all this time to write. And writing that album was cathartic. A lot of the Buddhist messages that run through it are absolutely sustaining factors during that time.
Right on.
You know, to realize the transient nature that even if life is shit, like you said,
I don't mean it that way.
No. It passes. And then you have moments of greatness, but then they pass also. And this sort of transitory nature of all things going by.
Yeah.
Including myself.
I'm a very happy person. Anyone who knows me, Bob, and anyone who watches the show that knows me knows I'm one of the happiest people you ever meet. You just heard me say life is shit. Like, that's just like when you come to that conclusion is where peace, in my opinion, comes from, because then you no longer think your life is shit. See, yeah. I didn't say my life is shit or your life is shit. I said life itself. So it's like you suddenly don't play the victim anymore. You don't go, poor me, for instance, for me, like, poor me, I can't walk. Like, who gives a fuck? Like, shit is shit, whether it's not walking or, like, having a mental problem or, like, a house, you know, parents that fight all the time, just anything you can imagine, it all equals out. And yet we pinpoint it to, I am the one that has the problem and everyone else's life is great. And it's like, life is shit.
It just, I think you're probably onto something, because, you know, if you look at Buddhism, the very first of the Four Noble Truths is
life is suffering.
Life is suffering. Life contains suffering. Yeah. So
I was just gonna say, if Kilo had just replaced the word suffering for shit or shit for suffering, however you live, then that would have been would have been the Buddha.
That was my modern, you know, maybe I am the crippled Buddha. You never know.
That's right.
Aren't we all a Buddha?
Yes, I mean, of course. Right on. Absolutely, there we go. Man.
So I'm on that line of like kind of the more mystical stuff. What keeps you inspired? Like when you, because it's been said that inspiration is like a well, you have to refill it, right? So you drain the well, you have to have rainwater to fill it up. What keeps you inspired to continue doing what you're doing?
Oh man, inspiration comes from a lot of different places. I will go back to something you said earlier and completely agree that as far as inspiration goes, the well of negative experience and negative emotions for me is a super creative force. I mean, it's a lot easier, I think, as a musician for me to translate that into music. It's really hard to translate joy into music, especially if you're going to try to put any lyrical thing on top. It's just hard. You might be able to pull it off with some instrumental things that can be uplifting and joyful, but man, it's a thin line between, you know, joyful and cheesy.
I agree. Well, you know, I'm a writer, as you know, and I've been writing lyrics my whole life. I started writing lyrics before I wrote anything else, right? That's always what I've done. And Kilo and I talk about this all the time, because Kilo and I we collaborate on music. That's what we do. Like, Zen Seeds was really both of us. And we've got a whole bunch of instrumentals that are coming out that are actually going to be they're going to be attributed to both of us. And it's all for an album that we're putting together anyway. But the point is, it's, they're all instrumental. If nobody's heard Zen Seeds, and I'm sure many have not, that's what, it's an instrumental song. And that's intentional. Cause I don't, to your point, I don't have anything to say in songs anymore because I'm happy. Right. You know what I mean? Like, I had a pretty good life.
Sure. Yeah.
I don't have nothing to complain about. So now I just want to make some music, you know, now I'm just kind of like trying to just make something pretty, you know, something good.
And we're not telling our audience to go out and fuck up their lives so they can be inspired. Yeah. Please, this is the warning of don't do that. Don't go do stupid ass shit. This will make your life harder. So you can be inspired, because the House of Static said that's the best way.
Every time, on every episode, Kilo does some sort of public service announcement, like, hey, don't worry, we say crazy shit, don't do what we say.
Okay, everybody. But I think it, music is a safe way for us as musicians to get our emotions out of us and make, because it's like sharing the burden, right? Because then, you know, every person that hears your music has a little bit of your burden. So suddenly it like releases your soul, if you will, to be okay with feeling that way, because then it's not just you that knows the feeling. You're getting,
sure.
It's better than just telling someone like, this sucks. Like, you're actually maybe possibly putting that filter, like you said earlier, into their vision, and then they're taking that weight or that burden of that.
Sure.
Uncomfortableness, or even that joy or whatever, you know, like, joy is more of a given, like, I give it to you because I want you to have it, and pain is more like, I give it to you because I don't want to have it, I think. But it's good for everybody, because when I hear songs that I've been through something similar, and I realize I'm not the only one, back to what I was saying, you know, and I realize, like, oh, wow, I'm not the only one that feels a certain way,
right.
Feels this way or that way, then I suddenly don't feel alone. And that's what we can do as musicians. It's so powerful. It's like,
it can be a tremendous kind of catharsis, and just dumping it all out, you know, the things that we hold in, because speaking for a lot of musicians is much more difficult than making music. You know, if you give me a sax, I can take the stage without nerves.
Yeah.
If you tell me to go out there and talk for 10 minutes, then there's going to be some nerves and pacing.
Public speaking is the worst. I've been on stage a billion times, and I'm never nervous until if you take the guitar away, and that's just me with a microphone. I'm like, oh, shit, you know. Guitar, yeah.
Good job.
It's really true. Yeah. It's hilarious. For sure.
So when you were talking about being a composer, and composers say that they can make music, like, or what did you say? Can you word it again for us? You said composers say they can put the feeling into your head.
Yeah, the idea of the old quote, and I don't know exactly where it came from, but this idea of the power of a composer is to transport the listener into the mind of the composer, to give them that state of mind.
Right.
That is the power.
On that point, I know that you put binaural beats into some of your songs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you put it in there because that is a way that you can almost physically do what a conductor thinks they can do, and literally put someone in a certain state of mind?
I don't necessarily think of it that way as I do it, because said, a lot of it just is the extension of what I feel being put out. And if that happens to put someone into a dark space, then I guess I was feeling the darkness, you know. But it's never necessarily an intention.
Right.
There's a couple of times where I've toyed around with some fun things of, like, I'm going to take these lyrics, which if you read them, are dark. I mean, you can dig them apart, but I'm going to set it to something that people will kind of move to and dance around, and they have no idea that underneath is what that is. But that's more of kind of academic exercise, taking my wheels turning, because sometimes the wheels stop and any little push can get them going fast again.
Sure,
And they stopped a long time on me once. I mean, I had a period of years where I just couldn't write. I just couldn't get things out. I had written a big piece, and then after that, I just felt like I had nothing left.
It's because you drained the well. You didn't replenish the well. You had drained it, and then you just have to sit there until the well fills back up again. Someone I know said it took 5 years after he did a soundtrack for a game for him to be able to, because that drained every ounce of creativity he had. But he was smart enough to know, I have to wait, you know. So that's what happened to you. You just kind of drained the well, and then the well has to build back up, you know.
But is it painful in the process, where you go, I can't write literally anything. I cannot write a lyric I'll sing. I can't write a chord progression that makes sense to me that I like. It just, everything becomes ruined by your mind. It just gets shut down over and over from within. But those days are gone. They may come back, but hopefully I'll be wiser if they do.
But
that's the thing about what we were talking about, pain. It just gives you this huge well of emotion, which leads to a well of inspiration, right? Because in my personal opinion, inspiration when you have an extreme lack of inspiration like that, possibly, is when you're not living in the moment. Because in this moment right now, we all have things that can inspire us if we are aware and present with this present moment. So when a tragedy happens, such as both of us waking up in the hospital,
right,
suddenly you're forced into a new situation where you have to be present.
You can't get out of that moment. You have, right? You're there.
Two tubes in your lungs, or you have a bad diagnosis, you know, like, so I feel like even though we're saying it's the darkness that brings the inspiration, it's more the awareness of that present moment.
Of your own being, right? Yeah bringing you back to center to somehow, yeah, in some sense. That's yeah, you know, Kilo, right on, right. Right on with the Buddhist sort of wisdom today.
I'm just talking, man. These are coming out of my brain.
You're nailing it, brother. Nailing it. It's fantastic. Yes, indeed. Winning. So, Noah, as far as the with the albums, right? And as they, and I wanted to actually go back to the binaural beats a little bit, but first,
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second.
I want to, too.
Because I think it's really interesting. But the reason, I dove deep into it when you told me about it, right? Because when sent me the album, he sent me an email saying, hey, by the way, this is what's going on with the album in my life. And also, I do these binaural beats, blah, blah, blah. So I looked it up, right? Because I know of binaural recording, which is something my friend and I used to do 20 years ago, which is a really wild thing to do. It's completely different. But if you binaural means two ears, right? So that's the idea. And
sure.
Binaural recording is you take a head, like a mannequin head, and you stick microphones in each ear, like PZM microphones, and it makes this crazy ass three-dimensional recording.
In college literally the nerdiest binaural setup of tiny clip-on mics that you could put on your head. Yeah. And I could go to like a show and like record this binaural bootleg of it.
That's awesome. Yeah. So we did the same thing, except we had a mannequin head. And we literally, my buddy, my friend Matto, when I talk about Florida, I lived in Florida with him. In the middle of our apartment, we had this mannequin head and we were musicians. We played all the time. So we would like record tracks and everything. And you put it on with the headphones and it sounds like it's very three-dimensional. It sounds like if I'm over there recording, when you put the headphones on, I feel the guy playing guitar over there. It's really wild. So anyway, but that's not what you did. So you mentioned that. I was like, oh shit. And then I looked up binaural beats, which is, this is the reason I brought up the thing, the speaker thing, the recording, because it's similar in a sense, because tell me if I'm explaining it wrong. I'll tell people what it is, and then you tell me what I did wrong. But basically, you take a beat, like say, like a kick drum.
Why don't you let him explain it?
Okay.
Well, Mr. Kilo, he's cracking that lip over there. I like it. He said, "I hear enough of you, Bob. I don't need
no, 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 no,
no, no." So the binaural beats is essentially, by studying the brain, okay, they figured out that the brain in different levels of concentration actually vibrates at different beat speeds, okay? But the speed at which the brain vibrates is far too slow for us to hear it. It wouldn't produce a coherent tone. And so through some horribly nerdy and wonderful scientists, they realized that they could actually take two tones, separate them so that two pure tones come in from each side, one here and one here. And if you make the difference between the two tones match that low thing, that low vibration that the brain resonates at, you can then get your brain to latch onto that.
Right.
So for example, if you're at 5 hertz, like very slow beat pattern, that's like a meditative state. If you were to take a 440, like an A440, and put it here, and put a 445 here, and then put on headphones, that natural wave or beat vibrato would then be 5. And it's that beat that happens through the two tones that then gets the brain to try to lock onto it and access. And it came from years of meditating, but then my brain is just like a lot of musicians, ADD brain. I mean, it's just going all the time. It won't stop. And so I'm very, very strongly Buddhist that could not meditate. I could not meditate. And then when I actually found binaural beats and started to use them in that context, I found that I could get my mind to be pretty quiet and pretty still with that as like a catalyst. If I put that on the front end for a couple of minutes, then it was easier to access some of the deeper levels of creativity and concentration. And so what I did was I just generated my own and then went through at different parts in Roundwood and put them in there, and hopefully in a way that you don't perceive them, because they are kind of notoriously ugly, because to a lot of musicians, it equals out of tune. Right. You know, if you put two things that don't quite match, but then integrating them in, like a lot of times they're in the lower frequency range. Mm-hmm. So you're not hearing a sub pedal. Right. You're actually hearing binaural beat on the bottom.
Right.
And then over the top, I put the remainder of the music, or if it's an ambient section, and then I go into that music and I sort of carve out that frequency range that I want those beats to move in. Mm-hmm. So that there's nothing that can clash with them, so that those two beats coming together will maintain that pattern, and then everything else sits on top without interrupting it. Kind of like you mix like a kick drum and a bass guitar. If you keep both vibrating at that same spot, they don't hit.
I've been doing that for the last week.
Right. That's right. Yeah,
I'm the guy who's been doing that exact thing with the kick drum and the low end for an entire week now, so I understand.
Calling me up at night going, I don't understand why this doesn't sound right.
Well, it was just phasing out. The low end was just, it was just bad. But it sounded right on studio speakers, but then when you put it on a sub, it was like, well, there was nothing there.
Right.
But we figured it out. So, anyway.
Yeah, cool shit.
It is cool shit. And
I'm glad that Kilo suggested you describe it, by the way, because yours was a lot smarter than what I was going to say.
That's not why. It's just that he actually does it. It's like, I'm not going to describe how to play a guitar, even though I mix guitar all the time.
And everything is relative. There's some scientist out there that actually knows far more about it, going, man, that was a horrible definition of binaural.
To our audience of non-scientistic minds, you just sounded very smart.
Yeah, there you go.
Watch out.
I will say that the actual practical application, the actual impact of it, right, on Roundwood anyway, is warmth. Yeah, I mean that it's a very warm and I don't know, I don't want to say wooden. That sounds negative. I mean warm, like you know, natural sounding. And it's and like I said, three dimensional. You know, what I mean, it's got a depth to it. Not, I don't mean, I mean obviously lyrically you have a depth to your songs, but that's not what I'm referring to. It's a depth of sound field or something. You know what I mean? You can just feel more there. It's beautiful, really.
And thank you for that. And in most of them, I intentionally only use the lowest level of binaural beats, because you can go into higher, faster beats that are associated with creativity and alertness and those things. Yeah. But then they can get pretty jarring if you're trying to put them in actual music and not just listen to it and meditate, you know. So, but I'm so pleased that you noticed it, because it's just a different kind of richness that somehow gets in there.
Yeah, it's cool stuff.
I just remember the first time I heard, Bob explained how he messed around with binaural sound in the past, but I remember the first time I even heard of binaural beats. I was sitting in my van, my hippie looking van, in front of my friend's parents' house when I was younger and in a band. And it's my friend who's passed a few years ago, but we're sitting there and we're on YouTube on one of our phones. And they were like, warning, this will cause hallucinations. This is my time ago. It was like, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, well, gotta try it now. Right now. So we like turned the whole, cranked the speaker system up and like, laid the seats back. Obviously, it doesn't do what they were like clickbaiting you to do back then.
Right. But, well, you didn't read the footnote that said, if you're on acid.
Well, maybe I was on acid. You don't know. You never know. But I mean, But I do agree with what you said. I do use it for, or I used to use it for meditation and sleep and stuff. It really, it because it, it you know what it's like? It's like tuning your brain's frequency, right?
Yeah.
It's like tuning it to a certain frequency to where you don't have to try to control your thoughts. It's hard.
Yeah.
Because if anyone's listening to this, you don't know what meditation is all about, and you think it's some girls in yoga pants, which it's not always, because we're three guys not in yoga pants. It's just kind of clearing your mind, right? It's just kind of taking your conscious thoughts away and just letting them go. And obviously, in a world we live in today, that's not a fucking easy thing to do. So to have something like that hidden within music where you don't even know it's doing that to you, right? It's one thing for me to click on an hour-long video and I know it's going to happen. So it doesn't work as good as when someone like you puts it into a song to where I don't know why I suddenly feel better, but I do.
Right.
It's very remarkable that you do that, because I haven't met anyone. And I live out in LA, and I, you know, I went to an amazing music school. Our guest, the episode before yours is going to air, which you guys are now watching it, so I don't know why I just said that, is the owner of Icon Collective. And so, anyways, but I've never gotten a chance to sit here and talk to someone who's actually done that, put it into music. So that's amazing.
Right. Well, you're right on the money, because they even call it brain entrainment when you're using it for that purpose. It's the idea of a little tool that can maybe help you get to a space, or maybe not, but it is there to kind of trigger sympathetic vibrations in the brain.
Hey, let's take a minute.
Tune in next week for part 2 of our conversation with Noah Avery.